Marion Burroughs is a New York Times syndicated columnist with the freedom to write about nearly anything related to food or drink that strikes her fancy. She has examined the revival of mashed potatoes and tackled the smooth or lumpy controversy. She's condemned restaurants as the last bastion of male supremacy. She's winced at chic foods like croissants filled with ratatouille, which are sure to become cliché foods. And she's investigated why seltzer loses its fizz in plastic bottles. Her column originates at the New York Times, where it's called de gustibus, a word from a Latin expression which means there is no disputing about tastes. The column is syndicated under the name Table Talk. Her new book, The Best of de Gustibus, is a collection of her columns on food lore, favorite recipes, and culinary controversies. Burroughs is a former Washington Post writer and the author of several cookbooks. Marion Burroughs, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You've been writing about food since 1959, excuse me.
Don't make it any worse than it already is.
And I bet the kind of food that you eat and the kind of food you write about has really changed since then.
Oh, enormously. It's one of the things that I write about in the book and had written about in the column. What, retro food.
Exactly. It's one of my favorite columns from the book. You went to a dinner party in which gourmet food from the 1960s was served. What were the kinds of foods?
Well, the terrible thing about the dinner party was that some of the recipes were mine from one of my first cookbooks.
Oh, no, that's great.
It was very embarrassing. Because we were all laughing an awful lot at what some of these things were. Hot dogs in sweet and sour sauce. Do you remember the miniature hot dogs that we used to think were so wonderful? Those were in sweet and sour sauce. Then there were also meatballs made with grape jelly.
Well, there were Swedish meatballs, right?
They weren't called Swedish meatballs, no.
Oh, I thought they served Swedish meatballs on that menu.
They served beef stroganoff, and they served a jello mold, and they served green beans almondine, one of my favorite old-time recipes. The desserts at the moment escape me, but it seems to me that they were a little bit better than some of the other things. And we were absolutely hysterical over this meal that these people, food people, had put together. And I wrote about it in a column, and I got some really, truly nasty mail back.
What, because people were still eating this stuff?
Oh, sure. And one of the worst things that could ever happen to anyone who ever wrote a cookbook was a woman wrote to me and said, because I was making fun of this dish that I had put in my first cookbook, and she said, "I've always loved your cookbook." This was the first one, called Elegant But Easy. "And now I find out that I shouldn't be serving the things in this book." I mean, can you imagine being told this? The best I could do was to write to the woman and say, "I was really only kidding about that dish. The other food that's in the book is really fine." Terrible.
Can you figure out why foods change as much as they do? I mean, I understand why fashions change. It's partly because... Well, it's for a lot of reasons that we won't bother to talk about. But I really don't understand why food changes. And I grew up thinking that the food I ate when I was growing up would be the food I would always eat. I mean, I had no concept that foods go in and out of fashion and that recipes are ephemeral.
Recipes weren't always ephemeral, and foods didn't always go in and out of fashion. If you had been born 60 or 70 years ago, the chances are that 20 years later you would have been eating pretty much the same thing. It's only what's happened in the last 15 or 20 years. And the French, in a way, started it. First, Julia Child made us all Francophiles. Mm-hmm. That was the first thing that happened to us. Then it turned out that the French were no longer honoring their classic recipes, and they were fooling around with them. They were experimenting, and they were making new things, nouvelle cuisine. Well, if they could do it, why couldn't we? And that was really the beginning of the food revolution in this country. Alice Waters followed thereafter with what we thought we were calling California cuisine, what she was doing. But now, 10 years, 15 years later, we're willing to admit that what she was doing, and she always said she said so, was really the food of Provence cooked with California ingredients. And little by little, we have all gone into our regional foods, looked back at our own regional things, started to grow the most wonderful things in our own regions here, and change the way we look at food. I think we are past the period where what is hot on the menu today is gone by the end of the week. I think we've slowed down a little bit, and we are growing more mature. But we still have a long way to go before we stop changing everything.
What are some of the foods that you think are merely trend foods now?
Trend foods now. There are probably a lot that I just can't think of. Well, it's almost out, really. Cajun food has gone all the way down the food chain, then now it's frozen food. You know it's out. It's not out in where it belongs. It's not out in Louisiana. But as far as being the trendy food, it's gone. Caribbean food is slightly trendy. I don't think that's ever going to be hot, and euphemistically speaking. And I think it will eventually disappear and then take its place in a little corner. We're big on Italian food in New York. They're big on it on the West Coast and maybe other cities too. Eventually, that will not be a fad anymore. It will just take its place where it belongs.
You mentioned how there's a revival now of mashed potatoes, mm-hmm. right? And that's a food that really wasn't served very much for a while. And it's interesting how foods like that go out of fashion. I mean, there's nothing trendy or offensive about mashed potatoes. I mean, how do foods like that fall out of favor?
Well, you know, they only fell out of favor with the trendsetters, the foodies.
Of course. Well, good
they
point.
They never
point.
Fell out of favor with your mother who cooked them at home all the time. That was when we left behind all of our own, our legacy, and said, none of this is good enough for us anymore. It's when we became Francophiles, for example, and then we moved on to other things. But now we're beginning to look at our roots once again, and it's about time. There are lots of wonderful American things. They may need a little bit of updating. But another thing that happened to mashed potatoes particularly is they made them instant. Well, then they were no longer mashed potatoes. They were just something to put in your mouth to make you full.
What kind of food did you grow up with?
Mashed potatoes, meatloaf, spaghetti and meat sauce, and tapioca pudding, lemon meringue pie.
Do you ever get nostalgic for that food?
Absolutely. I had a tapioca pudding, except it was called tapioca zabayon. Last year, when we were judging a contest for people, young American chefs were going to cook at a James Beard dinner for City Meals on Wheels in New York. And one of the entrants from the state of Washington was tapioca zabayon. Well, I was at the end of the meal, and I'd eaten a lot of food because we were doing sampling. I could have had two portions of it because it was tapioca. It was the most incredible tapioca pudding I'd ever had because it had zabayon in it. It was made with whole tapioca. But, oh, yeah. When you put me in front of really good mashed potatoes, I don't even want to share them with anybody. And I love meatloaf. I adore meatloaf when it's well made.
My guest is Marion Burroughs, and she writes about food for the New York Times. Her column is syndicated under the name Table Talk. Her new book is titled Degustibus. Am I saying that right, by the way, Degustibus?
That's the way I say it. I was told yesterday I was wrong by someone who interviewed me, so they told me it was Degustibus.
Ah.
I don't really know.
Okay. One of the columns that you did is about foods that people really hate. And I was very interested to see that warm milk topped the list. It was interesting to me because for years, and I haven't done this in years, I really liked hot milk. If I couldn't sleep or something, I found something very soothing about hot milk. I haven't done that in years. I've really lost my taste for it. But it was interesting to me that people really disliked so strongly
I think one
warm
of the
milk.
Reasons, but I think I know the reason because I know why I don't like warm milk.
Why?
It always gets a skin on it.
Uh-huh.
And that's when you're a child.
That's only hot milk, like scalded
but
milk.
But somehow it always seemed to end up on there. Even if you drank it warm, it had turned out and it was there for some reason. You know how children don't like bits of orange in orange juice? All kinds of things like that. I think that warm milk with the skin on it, it fits in the same category.
Well, you make an interesting point in that column, too, which you kind of touched on now, which is that people grow up hating the foods that they hated as a child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that when you form an aversion to a food, you kind of take it with you throughout the rest of your life.
Absolutely. Liver, for example.
Is that one of yours?
No. There's hardly anything I don't like. I love almost every food. But It's very interesting to watch a group of people go out to dinner, a group of grown-ups go out to dinner. If there is liver on the menu, there is almost always someone who orders it and adores it. And there is almost always someone in the group who said, oh, how can you order that? Or if they're too polite, you can see by the look on their faces that they can't figure out anybody could order liver.
You were a restaurant reviewer for a while with the New York Times. You spent 1 year doing that, and you write in your chapter about restaurant reviewing that no one could possibly pay you enough money to run a restaurant. Now, you love food, and I'm sure you love to prepare food. Why would you hate the idea of running a restaurant that much?
They also could never pay me enough money to be a restaurant critic again, by the way.
Really?
Yeah, it was the worst job I ever had. But that's another story. Why would I never open a restaurant? Because I couldn't give the kind of service that people would want. I would argue with them about why they didn't like something. I couldn't be polite enough to them. Running a restaurant, any kind of service business, is very, very difficult. And you have to have the kind of disposition that says the customer is always right. And I'm not that kind of person. Sometimes the customer is wrong. And the customer has no idea how really difficult running a restaurant is. And they really don't appreciate what the problems are.
Okay, let's get to why no one could possibly pay you enough money to be a restaurant critic again.
Where do you want me to start?
What's so terrible about it?
There are just two of us at home now. And my husband gets up somewhat earlier than I do. And when I was being restaurant critic, he always got up earlier and had left the house by the time I got up. Because even though he came home at the same time I did, he didn't have to transcribe his notes. He went to bed. So I didn't see him. I wouldn't see him all day long until it was dinner time. And at dinner time, there were always at least two other people with us. So I saw my husband alone for 20 minutes a day, approximately, when we were getting ready for bed. I was eating in restaurants often that I couldn't stand, that were terrible. I was eating all kinds of food I couldn't stand to eat. I gained weight and had terrible time losing. It's to this day I haven't lost it all. And I honestly never felt as if I was doing anything really worthwhile. It's also very difficult to write because essentially you're saying the same thing week after week after week. There is no real variety. You change the ingredients you're talking about, but you don't change what you say about them. It's a terrible job.
Well, you said that you resolved that you would walk out of the next restaurant that had a waiter who introduced themselves. They said, like, "Hi, I'm your wait person, John." Why do you hate that so much? It seems to be a commonly despised trait now.
I don't really want to know this man's name, and it means nothing to me. I don't want that kind of friendliness. I want warm, a personalized service, but I don't want him to become my buddy. He's not my buddy. Mm-hmm. He's waiting on me. And I want professional, discreet service. There's nothing discreet about that. It's the same kind of person says, "Hi, I'm John. I'm your waiter tonight." You want to ask him, "And what are you going to be tomorrow night?" It's really, there's something off. He's the same kind of person who takes the food and says, "Okay, who gets the tomatoes with the rice?" They really aren't professional if they do that. And that's one thing that I think that we need desperately in this country. Well, we've gotten professional chefs now. Very professional people. It's now time to fix up the front of the house.
I want to get back to that in a second, but did you ever really walk out if a waiter introduced
himself?
Hasn't
happened since then.
Oh, okay.
Must have read the book.
All right. Okay, getting back to professional waiters, one of the things that's holding that back is that being a waiter doesn't pay very much necessarily. I mean, if you work at a good place, you can make a lot of tips and do well. Chances are you probably won't have health benefits, right?
That's hard to say because a lot of that is changing now. And it's funny that you mention that because the government has just done something that may make the most enormous difference in how the front of the house personnel is paid. They are now collecting Social Security taxes on all tips. All tips, not just what the waiter declares.
Well, how do they know how much you've made?
They haven't figured this one out. They don't know what the government's going to do about this yet. But, in fact, since most of these houses that have really large amounts of money coming through are 90 to 99% credit card, everything is right there on the record. And the employer is now obligated to pay the FICA tax on the total earnings. This may turn everything upside down, and it may bring about the service charge. And if they do that, then the waiter will no longer be an independent contractor. He will be an employee of the house. There are certainly definite benefits to the house, and it may even be to the diners. The waiters have to decide whether it's going to be a benefit to them or not. Under those circumstances, they're very likely to get all kinds of benefits. Some of the better houses already do offer those benefits anyway, all kinds of health benefits and unemployment, et cetera.
Your concern as a patron of restaurants that waiters and waitresses aren't professional enough?
Right.
What kinds of problems have you run into?
Where do you want me to start? I've already told you two of them, you know, hi, I'm so-and-so, and who gets this?
Right.
Who they don't know what the food is. They don't know what the ingredients are in the food. They don't know how to serve it. They don't know how to be unobtrusive. You're in the middle of a conversation, they break into the conversation. Those are relatively minor things compared to many things that I've seen in restaurants, particularly in New York, where so many of the young people are in the acting business, and they are doing this to fill in. They will stand around in the back where you can see them, joking with their friends, smoking cigarettes, taking drinks. It's terribly unprofessional feeling about the whole thing, and it's that they obviously don't care a hoot. And wine people who can't pronounce the names of the wines and don't even know what kind of a wine it is. It's, when you're paying a lot of money, it shouldn't be that way.
There's a trend happening in some of the big cities in America, which certainly this is happening in New York, where you have to make reservations for a restaurant weeks in advance. And you write
months.
About months, yeah, and you write about how in some restaurants you have to leave a deposit, and you lose the deposit if you don't show up for the reservation that you've made.
Mm-hmm.
There goes spontaneity.
Oh, for certain restaurants? Oh, that's
when
right.
You have to start planning 4 weeks in advance what time you're going to have dinner. I mean, that seems so ridiculous.
Well, I guess we have partly brought it on ourselves because we have done things over the years like make reservations for three places, decide at the last minute where we want to go, and not cancel the other reservations. And there are many, many houses that find themselves with the place was overbooked and now it's a third empty. If they don't make their money that night, they can be in a lot of trouble. So they've had to institute, as a protection, a variety of systems like this, where you have to reconfirm the reservation, the deposit business. The thing that annoys me, and I mean, I can't blame them for the rest of any of this, because they have to protect themselves. But what annoys me is when they expect you to call back to reconfirm, when you've had one heck of a time getting the telephone number to make the original reservation. That, I think, is going too far. Most places, however, will call you, and that's okay.
Okay. I want to talk with you more about food, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is New York Times syndicated food columnist Marion Burroughs, and her new book is titled The Best of Degustibus. It's a collection of her articles, and we'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is syndicated New York Times food columnist Marion Burroughs. You recently had the New York Times do a survey for you to find out several things, one of which was, are people eating any more nutritiously than they were a few years ago? What did you find out?
We found out that there has not been any nutrition revolution. We asked people if they changed their eating habits in the last 5 years. This was a typical poll, the way they do a political poll. 1,870 people all across the country, telephone interviews, et cetera, weighted the way it was supposed to be weighted. 40-some percent of the people said they had changed their eating habits. 50-some percent said they hadn't. Then we asked them what things they were interested in, cholesterol, fat, et cetera. And many, many of them answered that they were interested in all those things. Then we asked them what they'd had for dinner the night before. And the people who were really interested in cholesterol had had red meat, French fried potatoes, no vegetable. What I'm saying is that even though there have been some changes, they have been very small and very incremental. There is no revolution going on at all. If people are eating less red meat, fewer eggs, they are eating more ice cream and far more fat.
Well, another thing that you found out in the study was who does in married couples, who does the food shopping, who does the cooking? And you found out that an overwhelming proportion of the women, working women, still are responsible in their households for the cooking and the food shopping,
mm-hmm.
around 90%.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Were you surprised to find that out?
No, not really.
That's funny, because when the women where I work found out about the study, we all said, we're not surprised to hear this.
No. And in fact, I have had the feeling that the younger generation, it may be even more conservative in some ways than the generation in between me and this young generation, people who are in their 20s now coming up. And I just had that recently confirmed by us. I don't know how good the survey is, but Gentleman's Quarterly did a survey on their readers. And they found out that less than 50% of the men approve of the feminist revolution. And more than 50% are more conservative than their fathers or their older brothers' generation. I don't know where we're going, but it sounds to me like we're going in the wrong direction.
What are you going to do with this information?
We broadcast it. Let everybody else figure out what they can. Several of the social scientists that I spoke with for the story said the only thing we can do about it is to talk about it a lot. It's already made a change in my household, I want you to know.
What change?
When I was in the middle of doing the story, it was on a weekend, and I had just finished talking to a social scientist who said essentially that to me. And I come from a moderately old-fashioned household. I do the cooking and the shopping, and I do the dishes. And that night, I turned to my husband and said, "Okay, I'm cooking the dinner. You're doing the dishes." And there's this terrible, shocked look on his face. But do you know, since that time, he's been doing the dishes. He didn't really give me a hard time about it. I just never thought to ask him.
Really? Well, how come it took so long to ask him?
I guess it never bothered me. Sometimes I would say, "Will you help me with the dishes?" He'd always come and help me with the dishes. I just hadn't thought about it. But I'm amazed at how maybe the whole thing takes 10 minutes, but this is an extra 10 minutes I have to do all kinds of things that I didn't have time to do before.
Of course, food has a different meaning in your household since it's your profession. I'd imagine how you'd want to do the cooking since you have to be trying out all these recipes all the time and experimenting with things.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I wouldn't expect him to cook, although if he wanted to do something, it certainly wouldn't bother me.
My guest is food writer Marion Burroughs. Your food columns always have really interesting twists to them. You're looking at, like, really interesting angles. Did you have to come through the ranks of much more traditional food writing before you were able to do this?
Oh, sure. I didn't start writing that column until 4 years ago. And I had already spent 20-some years writing traditional kinds of food stories. And I still write plenty of them because a lot of them interest me.
You know, we were talking about this study that you had commissioned from the Times with finding out, like, who does the shopping and the cooking in the household, and it's women. Now, the food articles used to always be on what was called the women's page, right?
That's right.
I mean, how much has that changed?
Well, we don't call it the women's page anymore. We call it the living section, but that's been for quite a while now, more than 10 years. And we do see a lot of men reading these articles. That's probably as far as it goes. No, there are some men who cook. Again, the revolution is very, very small. It's there, but it's very small.
Is it considered unimportant because it used to be related to the women's page? I mean, is it considered trivial?
Of course it's considered unimportant. Of course it is. We work in the back of the office. This is nothing against the New York Times. I love the place. It's been the same everywhere else I have worked. I'm not sure the top editors read that section regularly. I'm really not. Their minds, and newspapers are really relatively sexist places, and their minds are set on World News Tonight, whatever it may be, the A1, the National News, the Metro News. The Times has done something very interesting recently, and they have gotten rid of the woman's page sense of the stories that would appear on what was called the style page in the past are now appearing in the run of the newspaper. And it takes, I guess, some getting used to look for them in those places. But now you will find more features throughout the paper that ordinarily would have been on the style page. And you will find more things that the people who are in the style section, such as I am, I mean, that's the overall section, appearing on the front page of the newspaper than in the past.
Do you cook a lot for yourself?
We eat out a lot since we moved to New York. We didn't eat out very much when we lived in Washington regularly.
Do you still get a lot of pleasure in food when you're writing about it? For those of us whose profession has nothing to do with food, we can look forward to rewarding ourselves after a hard day's work with a good meal. But for you, that food is about work. Is it still as pleasurable to eat when it's your profession, too, and you have to really be thinking about what you're eating and figuring out how you're going to describe it?
The only time it really wasn't pleasurable was when I was a restaurant critic. Eating is still, unfortunately, an enormously satisfying and gratifying pleasure to me. I still love it, even if I'm thinking about what I'm going to have to say about it. I love it.
You know, you write about something that I really identified with. We were talking earlier about nostalgia for certain foods, and you write about having had a Good Humor ice cream bar. Mm-hmm. And wondering what it was going to be like. I recently had an ice cream pop from one of those food machines.
Mm-hmm.
It was awful. What a disappointment.
Terrible disappointment. Though, And those are the kinds of things, just what you're saying, is the kinds of things that people like to write to you about. We're talking about what's important in a newspaper. And my experience with the people who write to me because of this column is that what's important to them is that what the things they've had experience with and the things they know about. And very often they don't care about any, not one whit about what's on page A1. They care about the kind of ice cream they had when they were children. They want to write to you about it. And that's also what I've put in the book, the letters, parts of letters from these people. Not only the friendly ones, but the nasty ones.
Do you feel that you understand people now by what they eat? You know, that you can really kind of almost do a personality portrait of someone based on the foods that they prepare and the restaurants they go to and the dishes they like to eat?
in part. I certainly can tell something about the personality of the writers, depending on how they respond to a column that I've written. When somebody writes and tells me, I wrote a column once about being a latchkey child and how at the time I was a latchkey child, there were none of the awful connotations to it that there are today. Nobody said I was being neglected by my mother. And I got a lot of letters from people who had been latchkey children and how they felt as if they had learned to be independent. They were very positive letters, in other words. I felt that I would have liked to known these people because they had an empathy with my point of view. So that, therefore, I thought they were nice people. The people who write me nasty letters, sometimes they're very funny about it, and I think I'd like to know them, too. But sometimes they're just downright mean. And I think they really don't like food. And if they don't like food, I probably am not going to have much in common with them.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us about food. Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Marion Burroughs, who writes a syndicated column about food for the New York Times. The column is titled Degustibus, and the name of her new book is The Best of Degustibus, Food Lore, Favorite Recipes, and Culinary Controversies. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.